Okay, great. What we normally do is just start out with, and we do keep these down to 30 minutes so it doesn't take a lot of time out of people's schedule. They're really free-flowing calls. We'll just talk about whatever anyone wants to talk about. This session, we wanted to have a little bit of a break. We've had three sessions, the last three sessions we had 2 weeks apart. We had started off with 100th Point Family. They're in 100th Point Bayview out in San Francisco. And they were a someone just joined.
Matt Mancuso from Iowa Western.
Okay. The 100th Point Family was a community group which had a large naval base, and when the military came in, they built huge facilities, and they dismantled the Golmar Explorer there. It was during World War II. They built battleships, and as you would expect, they have about 5 or 10 Superfund sites and all kinds of brownfields in this community. The community kind of degraded, and it became an area where they put their wastewater treatment plants. San Francisco put their waste sites there. And then they isolated them with a highway, so it kind of made them an isolated part of the city that was hard to get to, but it had all of the everything bad in terms of city pollution and waste went to this area. And, of course, during periods of redlining, a lot of people were pushed from the more affluent areas in San Francisco down to the Hunter's Bay area. The ironic thing about Hunter's Bay is because it was government-owned and it was degraded, it turned out to be the last best Bayview location in all of San Francisco. And turns out it's extremely desirable land now because everything else has been taken up, and it's the largest piece of property, Bayview, looking over San Francisco Bay in the area. And, of course, they closed the base and they're trying to reclaim it. Well, you could imagine it's a perfect testing ground of what's happened to many cities of an area being degraded because of industrial development. And then now we're finding that this is extremely valuable property. And, of course, two things happen. We want to clean it. People will come in and want to clean it up, but they want to gentrify it. So the people that lived in these communities have been victimized several times. First, by the pollution that occurred. Somebody just joined.
This is Richard and George from Pittsburgh. Sorry we're a little late.
Okay. We're just having an open discussion and introduction about some of the people who were on previous times. This is about Hunter's Point. And the reason I'm saying this is many of your communities, to a lesser extent, reflect what happened in Hunter's Point, an area that became very industrialized, went downhill. The people in the community had been victimized with the pollution, the transfer stations, the wastewater treatment plants, the incinerators were all located there. And now as we run out of land, people looking at these sites and saying, hey, this is really a nice area. If we were to clean this up, we could make condominiums and golf courses, and it's very desirable. And this is exactly, it's magnified about 100 times at Hunter's Point. This is what happens to a lesser extent in many communities, and it's a perfect example of a brownfields job training program, because the whole idea is we're going to push the people out that live there, and we're not going to give them the jobs in cleaning it up, and we're not going to give them the jobs after it's cleaned up, but we're just going to either raise the rents and push them out. Well, the whole issue and the whole basis of the environmental job training programs is if we could train those people in the community, they can participate in the cleanup and the economic development. And if the brownfields are planned properly, they could live in the community in a mixed development area with good jobs, and they could benefit from all those decades of degradation that occurred in their community. And this is a perfect example of a win-win situation for everyone, and why environmental education environmental training can work. And the reason we mention it is if you and your community can identify, and this is the first step in developing one of these programs, identifying communities like Hunter's Bay Point that were economically disadvantaged, the people in the community were victimized, all of a sudden they look, the developers want to redevelop this. This is an opportunity. The demographics are there. The interest in EPA, Department of Labor, Department of Energy, and Department of Justice, they're looking for these kind of communities that we could take the indigenous population, people who live there, and we can make them part of this regrowth of this community. And they're all over the country. When we talk about the Philadelphia area, when the whole Bedford area, when we look at Detroit is another perfect example of Hunter's Bay Point on a much larger scale. We've got a river that's been cleaned up, and we've got this miles and miles of beautiful riverfront, but we've got a city that's been in economic decline. And all of a sudden, people are looking at these properties and saying, we could build a beautiful city, and in 20, 30 years, we could have an incredible city here. And the question is, are the people in the community going to benefit from this? And this is where these job training programs come in and why they're so important to the cities. And so the first person we talked to were Hunters Point, and they were a community organization that recognized this, and they applied for a job training program and received it, and they're just starting out. The second group that we talked to was St. Nicholas in Brooklyn. St. Nicholas was an identical community to Hunter's Bay Point on a smaller scale. It was all of the, they had about 50 brownfields. They've got transfer stations, wastewater plants sited there. They've got incinerators sited there, all in a small community. And the community decided, we're going to do something about this to preserve our community, and the way to do this is to train our people and to train them to get these jobs to clean up our community. So St. Nicholas was the same thing as Hunter's Point on a smaller scale. JFY in Boston was the third one, which is a little different. What we did is we started to look at the types of communities that are prime for these kind of programs. So if you're thinking about developing a program and you want to look at communities, those are the kind of areas you want to look at. Clearly, you don't want to go into the suburbs where there's plenty of training, community colleges, access to services, but looking rather into those communities that have been disenfranchised. Now, JFY, Jobs for Youth, is the whole entire Boston area. And the reason we talked to both St. Nicholas and JFY was these were programs that started out early in the job training program and had been funded five or six times. Since 2002, JFY had been funded. They had applied for EPA grants, and at that time they were two-year grants, and they were refunded about five times. St. Nicholas was refunded several times. And the issue there was these two programs did not receive funding this time. And the question is, what do you do when funding ends? So that is a prelude to what we're going to talk about in the next 20 minutes. Before we get started, though, Glo, do you have any news from Washington regarding where we sit on the next job training proposals?
Nothing since the announcement was made at the annual grantee meeting that we had in Alexandria. They still anticipate that the next RFP for 2013 grants will go out sometime in mid-December to early January, with a deadline for proposals due sometime in March. And actually, my project officer is on vacation right now, so I haven't gotten any updates since then.
Okay. And aside to that, GLO and HMTRI sponsored, which they sponsor every year, an annual grantee meeting. And GLO, do you want to describe that grantee meeting and what we do with that each year?
Well, the annual grantee meeting is a place for all of the existing grantees that are working on EPA funds right now and job training programs that have worked on EPA funds in the past to all come together and learn from each other and from their project officers. We have representatives from headquarters and all 10 EPA regions. And we gather the topics from the grantees that they want to discuss, and we have a very informal meeting based on the topics that everyone wants to discuss. So we have small group sessions and large group sessions, and it's a lot all about networking, all about not redoing what someone else has done, learning what barriers people have overcome and how they did it. I know that several of the callers that we have today were also at that meeting. So I don't know if anyone wants to add anything to that.
Okay. One thing I would add to it is anyone that participates in the professional learning community is also invited to that meeting. And when do you think the next one will be again? It won't be for a while.
Yeah, it won't be until next fall, anywhere between August and October. We've usually done it. We've been doing it in August for the past several years, but this year, because of the late release of the RFP from EPA, we had to move it back to October in order to get those new grantees into the meeting. So it'd be somewhere in that time frame.
One thing to know about EPA, originally they had hoped to have the RFP out around October, but there's going to be some changes in the request for proposal this year, and typically things occur at EPA later rather than sooner. So they don't have firm deadlines. So they had hoped at one time to have the RFP out and for the annual meeting, but now it's been delayed. And the reason they gave us for that delay was they're going to change it a little bit this year. It never changes too much, usually on the margins. But this year, those of you who are familiar with the grant proposals, they required a whole lot of training in a lot of different specific areas, and these were areas that helped kick in money to this program, and they include chemical awareness, and they included wastewater, and they did not include air programs. They did include the waste operations, and some of the criticisms of the program were there's limited hours in these training programs, so to touch on all these programs took a lot of time. So they're looking at a way of maybe having a concentration in a certain area. For example, if you want to have a wastewater program, you could go into that wastewater program. So anytime they're contemplating a change like this, there's delays. It will still be basically the same type program, and just it might be some difference in the curriculum and how you deliver the curriculum. But one of the things we found in starting up these programs is the curriculum you would think would be a major part of this, but actually the curriculum is not really the major part. And I'm sure Jason knows the work in city government attest to this, that coordinating and partnering becomes the major issue in setting these programs up. So, and we're going to talk about that in a second. One quick thing, and I'm going to put these all in the notes, just announcements. We've got three national meetings coming up. There's Brownfields 2013, which you should all try to get to. That's not till May 15th through the 17th, and it's going to be in Atlanta, Georgia. We're going to be presenting a workshop at that conference, especially designed for people who want to start job training programs. It's not too early to sign up for that. Actually, if you want to get in the hotel, which is the Omni, which is right on the property, it's going to be held at the Atlanta World Congress Center. It's a big conference center. In Atlanta, usually there's 3,000 to 4,000 people will attend this. I would recommend getting your reservations early because that will fill up real fast. but there are a lot of hotels in that area. And that's really a good conference to go to. All about brownfields and environmental job training programs, contacts relating to funding, contacts relating to tech assistance and that type of thing. All of the regional people will be there. All the state people will be there. So that's number one. I would, if you could find the resources to get to Atlanta, I would go. There's a slight entry fee this year. Usually it was free. There's a small amount to register. A second meeting that you may want to go to, particularly those of you involved in energy, is the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference. That's in April 16th to 18th, and that's in Washington. They have an open registration, I don't believe, but they're calling for papers. We usually are participating in that. And that has to do with all green jobs. A lot has to do with energy, and a lot of organized labor people are there, a lot of government people. It's going to be held in Washington, where they'll have a lot of governmental people. It tends to be more general, not specific to environmental education as much as just all green jobs in general. But if you can get to that in April, that's another good conference. There is one third conference which we occasionally will participate, but it's very expensive to participate. It's the NAWB conference, National Association of Workforce Investment Boards. And those of you who are associated with a workforce investment board may want to think about attending this. Workforce investment boards are integral to all these job training programs. And at this meeting, they all go, but the registration is really high. It's like $800,000. I mean, it's really expensive. And one of the reasons we haven't participated in the last couple of years, you may be able to get a scholarship or go on as part of an investment board. You may want to inquire on that, but I'll put notes in the notes, those meetings. There's going to be a couple webinars coming up, and I'll put notes on that. It's probably the one that would be of most interest is in November 2nd and 8th, one of our grantees told us about it. The AIRA, this is a stimulus program, has a firm that works with working with employers, placing your graduates and how to do it and different strategies. And I'll put notes to that on how you may want to attend that webinar. Again, in terms of funding that's going to be going on, there's an Environmental Justice Small Grants Award. It's $30,000. It's mostly for research projects, but they do mention the word education, and I'll talk a little bit about that in the notes. It's a RFP that's due January 7th for nonprofits. It wouldn't be a project that would – these funds wouldn't fund your program, but you might be able to work it as a planning money in terms of working if you had an environmental justice situation where you could develop a plan that might lead into a job training program. There might be an interesting play to get one of these small grants. And of course, Glo mentioned the job training program that will be coming up December, and that's not too late. When we think about, it won't be till December, it's going to creep out on you very fast. And what we want to do is talk today about starting your program, keeping it going, and then sustaining it. And particularly those who are new, and some of you who have been in the program already know this, selecting your partners is probably the strongest funding resource that you could find. And the reason I say that, if you were to look through the grantees, the active grantees that are currently on grants, you're going to find that many city organizations, City of Camden, City of Durham, Jason's program, their city governments, City of Texarkana, many of them are city organizations, City of Anniston, of course we mentioned City of Durham, one after the other are cities. So one of the, as you look at who is the fiscal agent for many of these grant programs, they're cities. The next greatest thing, there are community colleges, and we've got community college on the call. Community colleges become the fiscal agent. And then the third are very strong community organizations. We've got people like OAI out of Chicago, Center for Working Families, Memphis BioWorks Foundation. These are civic works. These are large pathways, large community organizations who have been in business for a long time. And what they're doing is they're adding on to an existing program. They're adding on an environmental training program for their community. So if here you stand and you're looking at getting a program started and looking at the startup funds, how do I get started? The first step may likely be contacting the city office. Now, Jason, which city office handled your program when you became fiscal agent?
Office of Economic and Workforce Development.
Right. Now, did they come to you, or did you decide that you were going to start one of these programs in Durham?
This program was started several years ago, and we've received funding each year in new grants. But it was something that I believe that was started off of an assessment grant, I think was the original grant that they received.
Mm-hmm. And that's a perfect example of how this might start. You received an assessment grant, and those assessment grants are being written as we speak. There's a due date in, I believe, November for the assessment grants. And what you may want to do is attach or find out who in your community has got brownfields assessment grants. These are grants to determine how bad the pollution is in your community and to see where in the community are the best candidates for revitalization, for cleanup. And these are funded by EPA. Now, in Jason's case, they started with this assessment grant, and the city was involved in that. And then the community college, I believe you all started a partnership with them to, okay, they could provide the training, and then you could become the fiscal agent. The nice thing is you're used to these federal grants. You've already worked with EPA. You've got your auditing. You've got everything you need in terms of getting this grant up and running. Now, you would think, why does the city want to get involved in ed training? But you're really kind of, I would say, farming that out in terms of a partnership with Durham Tech. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. We've got a wonderful partnership there where Durham Tech is able to provide the training for us, and it just works seamlessly.
Mm-hmm. And it's been a really successful program. And the nice thing about partnering with a city is that you could bring all kinds of resources to it. You could bring your life skills training from different agencies. You could bring in your placement and your recruitment services that you have in the city. And probably you have access to other funds. Would that be correct, that you could tap into and resources?
What we do have access to, and being that we are actually part of the Workforce Development Board, we do have access to our JobLink centers and our WIA resources as well. And that's probably been one of the biggest partnerships that we've been able to leverage through the Brownfields program.
And it's really neat because money that comes through from the state down to cities or from the federal government to the state to the cities, you have inside information on that money on the block grants, and everywhere from the Workforce Investment Boards to job links to even, and I don't know that you've used them, but other places have used the ex-offender programs where there may be some money available through ex-offender programs. And we know how hard it is for, EPA is an exception, but it's very hard for a small community group to go into these very large federal agencies and win these grants. But when you link up with a city, the city has access to block grants that are coming down. and the city determines how they're going to distribute these funds within the specs of the block grant. And a lot of these are community development grants that have enough latitude that they can assist you. And not only that, a city brings all kinds of infrastructure, we would say in-kind types of resources. And so it's not a coincidence that a lot of job training programs, the fiscal agent becomes a city. Now, that doesn't mean that if you're not a city, you should forget about this. What you need to do is approach the city, and the best place, as Jason said, is the Office of Economic Development. Look for either some of the old people are saying Brownfield's office, Office of Economic Development. If you're in a small enough city, you go right to the mayor's office, find out who is involved in economic development in your city. The next question you want to ask is, are you involved in Brownfield's? Are you involved in, have you ever gotten a grant, an assessment grant, or a cleanup grant? And with over 1,000 of these been issued, chances are, oh yeah, we're involved in assessment. Well, the next thing is, you know that only 10% of the assessment grants have associated job training grants, very small. And the next question is, would you be interested in developing a job training program for the city that would link to your assessment pilots? And at this point, hopefully a light bulb will light up and they say, yeah, we would consider it. Well, if that happens, you're on your way. And you would become a partner with them. And of course, the sharing of dollars is something that you just write up in the budget. But the fact is that they become the fiscal agent. All of a sudden, you've got lawyers, you've got accountants, you've got auditors, you've got everything in place, and you're going to become perhaps the coordinator or the trainer or the person who makes this thing work, but you're going to be linking with the city very closely, and they're going to be bringing in city services. And it's a very neat partnership, but it's a good way to get startup funding, because all of a sudden you've got resources. You didn't even have to apply for a grant. You just all of a sudden have a very large organization. Did someone have a question? Okay. So one of the strongest startup funding resources is the city. It could be a county, depending on where you live. So I would go there first. The second place I would go is look for very large community organizations that already have a track record and do the same thing you do with the city. For example, youth build programs. They're very strong. New Jersey Youth Corps, LA Conservation Corps, different, either they're connected to Pathways to Poverty, they have large Department of Labor funding. And these are programs that are often involved in construction trades and training youth in construction, like whether it's New Jersey Youth Corps or whether it's Conservation Corps or Youth Build, those may be they may be construction-oriented programs, but there's an easy sell to say, would you like to get started in an environmental job training program? Add it on, and it fits very well. And we'll talk about that in future PLCs. What you could do is you could add on to an existing job training program in construction and use all of the mechanisms that they have in place, all the facilities they have in place, and you're going to expand their curriculum to include an environmental job training program. Again, just as working with the city, you're working with a well-funded program who's got the accountants in place, it's got the lawyers in place, it's got the auditors in place, it's got the infrastructure in place, and you're just going to expand their program. And many of them are very positive to doing this. So what we're doing here, and we're going to have to talk about this in the next session, is how to get your program started. And for all of you who don't have programs yet and are thinking of doing this, I would look at these large youth build programs, community groups, and cities, and see if there's a place for job training in that program. For those of you who already have programs, even if you have your program, I would consider linking with them. And we're going to talk about this at a future date, linking with those cities for future sustainability. So if you've already got a job training program going and you may have an EPA grant now, this is a good time to talk about partnerships and alliances with the city. In fact, you're even in a stronger position because you could say, we've got this track record, we're ongoing, we want to now partner, we'd like to partner with you. And at this moment in time, you may not be a fiscal partner with them. You may be just partnering with them for issues of resources, non-financial resources. But at a future date, when it's time to reapply or when it's time to go off on your own, that partnership is going to be your best funding source and source of funds in the future. So we're going to talk about this some more on the next call and talk about these operational resources and sustainability resources. But does anyone have anything to add to that in terms of these startup resources that you might want to consider? Anything? Well, we're going to put these out in the post-session notes, and also with links to these webinars that are going to be occurring in the next 2 weeks, and also the announcements of these meetings coming up. And also, we're going to talk about the Greatest Institute, which is open to anyone that's involved in OSHA construction or ocean industry training. It's put on by Pete and Partnership for Environmental Technology Education. And it's a technical course on doing HAZWOP or 24-hour emergency response and confined space. So we'll put those all in the post-session notes. And if anyone has anything to add, they could send those emails back in terms of response, and we'll go from there. So, well, anyway, our next 30-minute call will be on November 7th. So we'll have, by that time, we may have a new president, so we'll see, or hopefully we'll have our existing president, so we'll see what happens. So talk to you all soon, and thanks for joining the call.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks.
Take care.
Okay, you all take care.